Okay. I welcome you all on behalf of IGNCA and Project Mausam to our monthly lecture series. This being the second series, the second lecture in the series. It is my privilege to welcome our guest lecturer this evening, Dr. Kurush F. Dalal, well known for his work and contribution to the field of archaeology. Dr. Dalal has participated in numerous archaeological explorations and excavations across the length and breadth of India. These include numerous sites, protohistoric, megalithic, early historic, and medieval sites. He has also conducted his own excavations as field director and joint director at the ancient site of Sanjan and as excavation director at the site of Chandor. He was assistant director of the Dinesh Modi Institute of Numismatics and Archaeology, and he is currently assistant professor archaeology at the Center of Archaeology, Center for Extramural Studies, University of Mumbai, and the coordinator for their archaeology, advanced archaeology, ancient Indian arts, crafts and sciences, and numismatics section. He has presented a number of papers at conferences, seminars, and workshops in India, and has published a number of research articles in peer-reviewed journals and edited volumes, both in India and abroad. The focus of his lecture today are the excavations at the site of Sanjan in Umargaon Taluk, District Valsad, in Gujarat, which has brought to light for the first time in Western India a complex early medieval inhabitation of the West Coast. The site has also revealed a burgeoning trading center involved in the Arab trade network, ranging from the Persian Gulf to China. It has also uncovered evidence for the early presence of the Zoroastrian community on the West Coast of India, and the site has yielded the first definite proof of Parsi occupation at Sanjan in the form of the Tower of the Silence. I would now request Dr. Dalal to present his paper and enlighten us further on the site. Thank you.
So, thank you very much for having me here. IGNCA and Project Mausam, thank you Professor Ray and Dr. Mangalam and all of you all who are here. I'd like to lay down a little background before I do this. The excavations at Sanjan probably took place for all the wrong reasons. And now that enough years have passed, I can say this without flinching. There is an organization called the World Zarathustra Cultural Foundation, or the WZCF. And the gentleman in charge of that organization, Dr. Dhala, who's not an archaeologist or a historian, was very interested in preserving Parsi culture, Parsi Zoroastrian culture. And he felt that the caves at Bharot, which are on the Maharashtrian border, just with Gujarat, needed desperately to be saved. This is one of the few pilgrimage centers as such that the Parsis have. The Parsis, after coming to India, never really wrote down their histories. They became truly Indian in that context. Like most other Indians, they had quasi-mythic histories. Well, the only really even semi-decent effort is a very, very late, terrible poem in Persian called the Kisse-i-Sanjan. It was written in 1600 AD. So that's a hell of a long time after they supposedly came down. And it's the only written record, or rather the earliest written record as such, of the Parsis coming to India by the Parsis. What we do know about the Parsi exodus is that in 641 AD, the Sasanians lost to the Arabs at the Battle of Nehawand. In 651 AD, Yazdegerd Shahryar III died. And well, within the next 100 years, all resistance came to an end. Even the short-lived dynasty of Duristan and the kings who ruled in the Mazandaran area along the Caspian Sea, the south of the Caspian Sea, were soon defeated with the coming of the Umayyad Caliphs. And this brought an end to the Zoroastrian kingdoms of Persia. According to the oral traditions of the Parsis and this text, the Kisse-i-Sanjan, one group of Parsis from this region of Khorasan, which had held out for over 100 years against the Arab invaders, made their way south to the port of Hormuz. So please note, this was already 100 years after the event. They stayed at Hormuz for about 30 years before they took ships and sailed to India. They arrived in India not at Sanjan, as most people believe, but originally arrived at the island of Diu, where they stayed for 19 years. And they finally made landfall on the mainland at a site they named Sanjan in memory of a similarly named place in the Khorasan Mountains. So Sanjan was founded supposedly by these refugee migrant peoples. Now, the first question to ask that bears asking is, why in God's name did they land up where they did? And what were they doing on that fly speck of an island called Diu for 19 years? The only way it makes sense is if there was an organized and very large exodus. You know, not just people running with the clothes on their backs to escape the Arab invaders like the picture is painted normally. So only if there was a large enough body could they have set up a urban center, number one. Number two, and perhaps more important, the location at which they have ended up setting this is a tribal buffer zone between the Rashtrakuta Shilahara held lands to the south and the Gujarat lands to the north, the kings of Gujarat to the north. So you're looking at a zone where they would not have upset the political balance because their numbers were large enough. At least that is the only thing that makes sense to me. And that they came fully prepared is very obvious because they didn't come here and go into hiding or something, but continued to be a part and parcel to a large extent of the trade network that was part of the Indian Ocean littoral at this time, as we will see during the rest of the talk. The WZCF, when they decided to first work at the caves at Barot, did so because the caves at Barot are supposedly where the holiest icon of the Zoroastrians, the Iran Shah fire, which was lit at Sanjan in Thanksgiving, and according to Parsi legend, has never gone off to date, was squirreled away from Sanjan when Sanjan fell to the armies of one Sultan Mahmud and his general Alaf Khan. Now, trust the Parsi chroniclers to use such absolutely useless names. There are probably about 7 contenders for that Sultan Mahmud. Almost all of them had a general called Alf Khan. Alf Khan just means the number one Khan. So it's a title, it's not a name. The Kissei Sanjan tells us about the heroic defense which lasted 2 days. On the first day, they held back the army. On the second day, they lost. But they gave the priests enough time to run away with the holy Iran Shah fire. And those same priests supposedly escaped to the hills of Barot, where they hid in the hills of Barot, in the caves of Barot. And then when the coast was clear, they moved from there to Basra, from Basra to Navsari, and ultimately to Udwada, where the fire reached in 1741-42 AD and continues to be there even today. So Udwada is, well, Mecca, Medina, and all of the other holy of holies for the Parsis. The only other spot of any pilgrimage, really, are the caves at Barot. The WZCF wanted something done there. Now, sadly, the caves at Barot are actually all water cisterns. None of them were caves to be lived in. And this was something that is very difficult to explain to a non-archaeologist or a non-art historian. Because you go there and you just see these caves. In the overgrown hilltop, you don't see the small fortress. You don't see the houses over there or the plans of the houses. So you decide that these dry caves were where they hid. So this has ipso facto become the most important, the largest of the water cisterns, which is dry about a month and a half after the monsoons, has ipso facto become the number two place of pilgrimage for the Zoroastrians. When the WZCF proposed to do this, they brought aboard a historian, the late Dr. Mani Kamerkar. Dr. Kamerkar immediately, very categorically told the WZCF that if we did not establish the veracity of Parsi Zoroastrian existence at Sanjan, there was no way that we could identify these caves as actually having any locus standi. So therefore, it was decided by them to take up excavations at Sanjan. This was not enough. Neither of them, I mean, Dr. Karmarkar was a very respected historian, but she was not an archaeologist either. And they approached Dr. S.P. Gupta and said, we want to excavate Sanjan. Dr. Gupta was most happy to help an old friend of his and said, sure, I'll help you get permission and try and get you some funding. You're a historian, why don't you write to the ICHR and see if the ICHR will help you too? So Dr. Karmarkar wrote into the ICHR, which very gladly gave us a two-year project. And the ASI also gave us what are called matching grants and helped us to conduct the first two seasons of excavations. I was approached and asked whether I would like to be the field director of the excavations. And that would be like telling somebody with a fresh MBA whether he'd like to be a vice president at Tata Sons or at Reliance or I don't know where else. And I was absolutely gobsmacked and said, yes, and I'll be in Bombay in 48 hours and we'll meet up and you tell me about it. When I went there, they told me what they wanted. And I said, okay, so let's, you know, put the due processes into place, explorations, this, that, and the other. And I said, who has gone and verified the existence of an ancient settlement at Sanjan, which is to be excavated? And they looked at me and said, isn't there one? I said, what do you mean by isn't there one? So nobody knew whether there actually was anything to excavate at Sanjan. They had already applied for permission to excavate at Sanjan the day before I arrived with my name on it. So pell-mell, I hurried back to Pune because I needed maps. I needed maps which in its infinite understanding, the government of India will not give us access to because they're coastal maps. So there are copies of much, much older series of maps at the Deccan College. So I managed to get the relevant map, used what little archaeology I knew to figure out where the site should be if there was one, and hurried by the end of the week to Sanjan in the hope of finding something. I also tried explaining to my principals that what they were trying to do was establish ethnicity through archaeology. And that this was an incredibly dangerous precedent to try and set. Not to mention that it was virtually impossible. The odds of actually establishing ethnicity through archaeology are very, very dim, especially when you're looking at something like the Zoroastrians. I explained to them that a brick was a brick, a bowl was a bowl, a nail was a nail, a knife was a knife. There was no Hindu knife, Muslim knife, Parsi knife. So if I came across the regular accoutrements of everyday use, I was hardly going to be able to tell whether there was a Parsi or Zoroastrian occupation at this site. They didn't seem to think that was a problem. So I said, I'll do my best, but I don't really think I will be able to. I must say that I surprised myself when we did. So at least maybe being negative is a good way to start off, because then when the positives happen, you just feel happy about them and not disappointed. So this is the location of modern-day Sanjan. And modern-day Sanjan exists just across the Maharashtra border into Gujarat. So this is the Maharashtra border, and this gives you Maharashtra-Gujarat border and gives you an idea where Sanjan is. To give you a further idea, modern Sanjan has only a west railway station. There is only a Sanjan west. There is no Sanjan east. Because if you were to get off in Sanjan east, you'd be in Maharashtra. I mean, that's how close to the border it is. When I went there, the only written evidence about the existence or non-existence of Sanjan was a small entry in the thesis by Roxana Irani. Please note, Irani, not. And she said that modern-day Sanjan lies over the remains of ancient Sanjan, and therefore ancient Sanjan could not be found. What I realized was that modern-day Sanjan was a railway station. And it was part of the Bombay Baroda and Central India Railways, which was started after the 1850s. And therefore, the site of modern Sanjan could not be more than 150 years old. You see, when the railways were started, railways were laid in straight lines. Every so many kilometers, or rather so many miles, you had to put up a railway station, irrespective of whether there was occupation or not. So a lot of railway stations would pick up the names of the nearest villages. The nearest village might be 4, 5, or 6 miles away. So we took heart that there might be more to Sanjan than just the railway station area and decided to carry out explorations there. The only other existence of Sanjan, and of course we found out later, is Bokaro's famous series of maps. Bokaro was a Portuguese cartographer who drew maps of all the Portuguese overseas territories. It's one of the greatest treasure troves of data. And on the creek north of Danu, he talked to us about the fort of Samjez. Now, Sanjan has been anglicized numerous times and lusophied in this case. So you have the Portuguese calling it Samjez. You have a later name of Saint John given by the British, okay? Because they are translating Samjez or Sanjens, okay, directly. And they were further anglicizing the name of Sanjan. And that's a very interesting series of, changes if somebody's interested in the literary part of it. So the modern side of Sanjan, as I said, is a railway station. The ancient side of Sanjan actually is about 2.5 to 3 kilometers to the north of it, to the north-northwest of it rather, and is at a place called Sanjan Bandar, which was the original village. About a kilometer further away from Sanjan Bandar on the banks of the Varoli River or the Varoli Creek lies the Sanjan Machiwad, which is where the fisher folk have their village. And that village actually lies right on top of the archaeological mound of Sanjan. So this is to give you an idea of where the railway station is. You can see the railway line very clearly running straight down in a diagonal slash. You can see where the station is and modern Sanjan is. And you can see where ancient Sanjan is at the confluence of the Varoli and the Koli Khadi, which comes down from the north. So there are these two seasonal rivers or rivulets, and they join together, and at that confluence is the ancient site of Sanjan. Now, no, 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 no. Okay, this is something that also has to be clarified for all early historical and early medieval port sites in Western India. Now, I might be treading on some people's feet over here, but there is not virtually a single medieval, early medieval, or early historical port site which is on the coast, None of them face the sea ever. The simple reason is that, as the Project Mawson people will tell you, all seaborne traffic is wind driven by the Mawson, by the monsoons. And when you're coming with the monsoons behind you, a landward anchorage on the littoral is suicidal. You're asking to be smashed into the sea, by the sea into the land, if you do that. So all ports are inland ports. Every single port is an inland port. So you have to look preferably from the highest navigable point of any creek. And as we found out, much to our surprise, there are very, very interesting dynamics that nobody seems to have ever taken into consideration till we actually got there and learnt about the problems that existed. So this is a close-up. This is the Portuguese fort at Sanjan, the fort of Samjez. This is Sanjan, modern town and railway station. This is the ancient mound of Sanjan, basically. This entire area over here, it's huge. There is a lake over here, a man-made lake. And right till the modern period, there was a port or an anchorage at this point over here. Till 40 years ago, this was an existing port shipping wood and bamboo out of here to the Gulf. In fact, Al-Masudi talks about it in great detail if you read some of his stuff, and he will tell you about the bamboo that is used in the Persian Gulf ports for the erecting of houses. It's all coming from Basra, which is a small, large village, oblique small town in the bamboo forest, Basra, okay? And the materials from Basra are being shipped down overland to Sanjan, from Sanjan across the sea into the Persian Gulf and the Red Sea. So This is basically the layout of Sanjan, the site of Sanjan. And these are some of the other main locations. This is more or less the highest navigable point on the Varoli Creek. This is something that you need to wrap your head around. At least it took me some time to wrap my head around. When we think of a port, we see something like Bombay or Calcutta, not Calcutta. Calcutta is probably a good example of something like this. We think of Madras or Cochin, and you just come in and there's the wide sea and there are quays and wharves going out and large ocean going ships stuck over there, traffic coming in and out all the time. This is not how a medieval or early historical port works. In the case of Sanjan, you could only access the port of Sanjan twice a month. Twice a month, note. There's a 3-day window. The day before the full moon, the day of the full moon, the day after the full moon is one window. Ditto for the new moon. The day before, the day of, and the day after the new moon. These are the two windows to get in and out of Sanjan. And that is being used even today by the ships that come to Sanjan port. So this is the medieval site. You actually come up and you run your ship aground over here. So you come up the creek, this is at low tide, and you come up, it's full water, and you run it aground over here on the soft silt, which is at this edge over here, which is the depositing bank. If you've noticed, this is the cutting bank over here, this is the depositing bank. There's lots of silt. You run your ship up. You have 12 days to load, unload, make your deals, inspect your goods, make your sales, set up shop. So if you come in at new moon, you leave at full moon. You come in at full moon, you leave at the next new moon. You bunker, you take on your food, you take on your water and everything that you want to. And it makes a lot of sense. None of those ports in those days were that busy that ships had to come in and out of them every day. None of the products that they were really bringing were in such enormous quantities or so vital that they needed enormous tonnage shipping out on a daily basis. And for example, if you read the Periplus, it'll tell you exactly the same thing. Now, you see, a lot of people don't understand why they were doing this coastal trade thing up and down the coast in the Periplus. And it makes sense. You come in with the monsoons, you've got three and a half months to kill before you can go back with the returning monsoons. I'd actually say maybe 4.5 or 5 months. So you do whatever ports you want to do. You brought a wide variety of goods. You might even do some shipping for local people before you ship out back with what you want to take. You'd have a factor in the port where you've collected what you want to. You might not even sell anything there. You might sell things at other ports. So a lot more work than has been done really needs to be done on literary sources. And a lot of common sense has to be used. And a lot of practical common sense requires people to be on the ground to recreate these things like we did, to understand what the problems are. So this was the number one source of water in the medieval period and is a freshwater lake even today, though today it is used mainly for washing clothes. This is a seagoing Machi fishing boat, roughly 30 tonner, which actually would be more or less the tonnage that would be shipped out during the medieval period. And this is at almost full tide. He has just come in with a full load. You can notice the dugouts lined up over here. You can notice the smaller vessels over here that will be used to navigate the creek when the waters are lower. When we carried out explorations here for the first time, we came across some very, very interesting glazed ceramics. One kind gentleman had just bought a plot of land and run a bulldozer through it. So there was a lot of plow zone archaeology that we could do there. And well, you have to make the best of a good thing, right? Or a bad thing. So when we first got this ceramic, we had no clue what it was. And we showed it to some of our very, very senior colleagues who said, yes, yes, this is very common. This is, you see, all the sites in northern India, this is always there. So I said, really, that's fascinating. What is this? Mughal. So I said, oh, damn good. So we got a Mughal period occupation here. That should turn a lot of heads, you know, and upset the apple cart. So we looked at a lot of Mughal ceramics. and I didn't find any damn thing like this. Now, I'm a great believer in serendipity. I'm an agnostic. The only reason I'm not an atheist is because of serendipity. So just when we were trying to break our heads and figure out what this was, along comes a gentleman who has been working on trade coming out of the Persian Gulf, and he gives a small lecture at Deccan College where he talks about this very interesting ceramic called the Sasanian Islamic turquoise glazed ware, or the hib ware, which is found all over Southeast Asia at port sites which were used in the terminal Sasanian and early Islamic period coming out of the Persian Gulf. And my ceramist on the spot, Dr. Dandekar, says, "Oh my God, hallelujah, jackpot, this is what we've got." So we realized that what we were looking at was the Sasanian Islamic turquoise glazed ware. Very large vessel. This vessel would have been about this high, rounded, going down to a flat base, conical flat base, with very nice applique design. This is called the Tree of Life design. And we have identical vessels from Susa and from the site of Banbhor. Banbhor is at in Sindh, on the banks of the Indus River. And before the excavation at Sanjan, it was the only published data, okay, from Southeast Asia, from South Asia, for this kind of material. The only other known site which was unpublished at that time was the site of Mantai in Sri Lanka. Not a single sherd of this prior to Sanjan had ever been found on the Indian mainland. I hear my friends down in Kerala are now taking it out by the trunkful. So we started excavating, and we had a very, very peculiar stratigraphy. For those of you all who are archaeology students, the entire upper 1 meter was virtually brickbat jelly that you can see in the back of the screen. Just tiny, tiny, tiny little bits of brickbat jelly. It made absolutely no sense. Collapsed structures. And then when we got down, we hit ring wells. Now, this scared the hell out of me. I chalk it down to inexperience. As far as I was concerned, ring wells were an early historical phenomenon. So I was in complete panic. And I was talking on the phone to a senior colleague of mine. I said, no, not true. We are having them in Tamil Nadu in the 12th century AD. So, okay, thank God for that. If they are having them, we can be having them too. So we had two beautiful horizons, both of which used ring wells. And the lower ring well, of course, has collapsed down into its own pit, but otherwise would have been at layer 4, which was the earlier level. And at the base of layer 2, we had the heyday of the site, which we could date between the 10th, 11th, and the 12th centuries AD. And the site basically existed between the very late 8th century, early 9th century AD, and the 13th century AD. This was one of the most amazing finds at the site. To the best of my knowledge, it is still the only excavated Abbasid dirham ever found in India. If there are any others, I would be very, very grateful to be told. And like I'm telling you, this is once again all about serendipity. We had a beautiful ruined structure that we had exposed for early morning photography. You know, soft light in the morning, blah, blah. Spent the whole day prepping the shot, and we left in the night. We came back in the morning, and my beautifully set photograph had been ruined by a bunch of kids playing through my trench who had knocked off a corner brick. So the first thought was to put the brick back quietly, act like it wasn't pushed off, and carry on working. Then the archaeologist in me said, no, you can't do that. So he said, never mind, we'll ruin a full day and put a chowki there for the night, and we'll get rid of the cementing material under the brick that has now been kicked off. And in the cementing material, we found 2 silver coins. So had those kids not got in that trench, had they not kicked that, I would have never known that there was a cut Abbasid fraction in Sanjan. Now, this is very funny. All over Europe, there are tens of thousands of Abbasid fractions like this being found. The Germans can show them to you in bags from the early medieval period. They're available all the way in Scandinavia. Is it just that we have never identified them in India? Yes, and we just don't excavate early medieval sites. If we do, we rush through them. So this is definitely Abbasid, most probably Harun al-Rashid, and that would be about 140 141 or 171 Hijri, if I'm not wrong. Next to it was this. This is the first known silver Rashtrakuta issue of Amoghavarsha. Interestingly, it's in Brahmi. It's late 9th, early 10th century AD. Actually, I would say 10th century AD. And it says Sri Amoghavasa. This is the reverse. Elephant walking towards right on dotted line with dotted border, or beaded border as it's called. Tiny hemidrachm size. Alongside these, we also found coins of the emirs of Sindh. By the way, we have two of these, so this is not just a one-off. We have a lot of coins of the emirs of Sindh datable to the 10th, 11th centuries AD. We also have a number of local Gadia issues. This is almost pure silver. A large number of different kinds of beads that we came up with. Some very, very beautiful eye beads. The one on the right got washed by mistake, so we are very happy about the mistake. It looks good in the picture. Otherwise, you shouldn't take off the patination on your beads. We have some amazing beads in amethyst-colored glass. We have some gorgeous beads which have subsequently turned up in agate. And we know that the beads were a major source of trade during this period. We also have carnelian beads, which we've known of from the Harappan times. And interestingly, the ubiquitous arecanut-shaped terracotta beads, which we have from the pre-Harappan period, continue to be used into the 12th century AD. This is an identical bead from Syria, very similar to the glass bead from Sanjan. And we believe that the glass eye beads from Sanjan are actually from the Syrian region, where they're dated to an earlier period of the 7th, 8th century AD, but we definitely have them in a later context in the 10th, 12th century AD. We also have a lot of these segmented gold foil glass beads. And these are supposed to be late Roman gold foil glass beads. It's called gold foil because it looks like there's a thin gold foil under the glass. Actually, there is no gold foil in a gold foil bead. There are real gold foil beads, but let's not go into those. The bulk of them actually are just two different kinds of glass. And the refraction of light through it gives you this fake gold effect. So this again is part of serendipity. When we excavated in the second season, there are a lot of problems when you're not an institution, you don't have government backing, and you're freelancing in the field. We went back to the site in the second season and were promptly told that we were persona non grata in the entire Machiwad. Because the word had spread that if we kept digging over there, people's children would die. You can't work against that kind of this thing. If people believe their children are going to die, you just have to walk back. There's no explaining to people, because if somebody's child actually does die due to some completely different reason, well, unlike Sankalya's Born for Archaeology, your biography will be very short and will be called Dead for Archaeology. So we moved to a new location on the periphery near the Kolikhadi, and I went there for a three-month excavation, and my excavation almost got over on day 12 or 14. Because it's a very short deposit of about 40 centimeters, and that was it. One of my teammates, Aravali, who is now in Tamil Nadu with the ASI, was trimming one section when a long human bone came out, because he trimmed it a little too deep. Serendipity again. And we discovered an entire cemetery over there, and we had three very good months. We got very friendly with the locals, and we went back in the third season to the main mound. And one night, one of the local gentlemen came over to meet me and said, you know, they collect these beads even today, and they tie them around their children's arms and legs when they're very tiny, for the same reason that eye beads are used elsewhere. You know, this is a Najarbattu. So he said, when my son was very young, I paid children because I had a little shop to collect these beads on the site, and I paid them one orange sweet each. And even today, it's a very big thing, and this is part of the ethnoarchaeology part of it. We have babas of different kinds coming down to this dargah over there, And they spend their time after the monsoons walking the mound looking for beads. And their great value is set on these beads by some of these wandering mendicants. So he said, I have a necklace of these beads that I have collected, and he plonked this in front of me. And I kind of salivated and drooled, and he said, my son is now grown up and has his own children who are grown up, and I want to sell this to you. So I said, okay, that sounds very interesting, please go on. And I was wondering as to how much money I'd have to spend out of my own pocket, because official funds would not go towards buying something like this. And he said, I will quote only one price, and I will not take a paisa less. So I was thinking, how high can I go? 2,500, 3,000, four, maybe I can go 4,000. Because I had every single one of these beads from my excavation. And this would have been perfect for display, because I would not have to string up my beads and go mad numbering them and worrying about them getting lost. And he said, I want 250 rupees. Now, my name is Dalal, right? So I beat him down to 225 on principle. Then I paid him 250, much to his complete bewilderment. But he just can't take his price because he quotes it, right? So an amazing array of very, very beautiful beads with no evidence of their manufacture here. Please note, very important, not the slightest evidence of their manufacture, but huge variety of pendants and beads at this site. The most common, of course, is the small, slightly flattened globular bead that you see towards the end of the necklace. But all these pendants and the large bead in the center and these carnelian beads we have from the other excavated contexts also. Excavating the first season, we found, and I've got to do something about this photograph, I apologize for the abysmal quality. On the floor of the house that we were excavating with the coins, the Abbasid coins, a beautiful faceted glass bottle and a rectangular cross-section glass bottle. Now, I had never really come across much glass in my excavations till I went to Sanjan. We realized at Sanjan that what we should have had was a glass yard like a pottery yard, because every lot of 5 centimeters in a 2.5 by 2.5 meter quadrant, we were coming up with 400-500 sometimes fragments of glass. There was an enormous quantity of glass, and there is nobody who has written anything on the medieval glass of India. I'm saying that with absolute surety. I know, because my article with Riya Mitra is probably the only one floating around on the glass. And there were just no funds to carry on this work. We had no idea where to go. And on one visit to Strand Bookstall in Bombay, much to our surprise, there was a catalogue of the Al Sabah collection of glass. Now, the Al Sabah collection of the Emir of Kuwait is the definitive collection of Islamic glass in the world. And he had had the entire assemblage curated by Carboni. And Carboni's book, for some reason, ended up at, see, serendipity. Serendipity in my life. That's what my autobiography is going to be. Was in Strand Bookstall, and my wife Ria just opens it at random, and there sitting is this picture. So I have an 11-sided glass bottle. Carboni has a 9-sided glass bottle and a 13-sided glass bottle that are identical. I think the Emir of Kuwait would pay quite a lot of money for my glass bottle. And these are securely dated to the 9th, 10th century AD and are coming from West Asia. So we could pinpoint where our glass was coming from. It was coming essentially from the Mesopotamian region. This is, of course, the deeper ring well that went down all the way to the bedrock. And as I told you, in the second season, we ended up exposing an entire burial. I apologize about the missing hand on this side, but if it hadn't been knocked off by my friend Aravali, we wouldn't have found the rest of them. We expanded our trenches to get one burial into the trench. And we found the next one over here. So this was human skeleton 2. And then we had to open a slightly larger trench here to find the rest of him. And, you know, the trench lines came here, and then the trench line went through a bone here. And then we had human skeleton 3. And then when we were kind of getting a trench line made here, we had human skeleton number 4. And then we had human skeleton number 5. And ultimately, we actually had a skull in the section called human skeleton number 6. And it was damn difficult to photograph, and my friend Abhijit almost broke his neck. That's his toe, the boot over there in a tree, very precariously balanced, trying to get an idea of the burial complex. Now, What was very interesting was that these burials were on the periphery of the site. They were the terminal, they were the absolute terminal use of the site. When we brushed the rest of the mound, we found about 12 to 14 small depressions, which would have corresponded, we feel, to other burials extending southwards on the mound itself. These burials had been made after the site had come to a close. They were the last thing that was done on this site were these burials. Now, according to the quasi-historical traditions of the Parsis, the site of Sanjan was destroyed by Sultan Muhammad's general Alf Khan. We hypothesize, purely hypothesize, I have no proof, that if this did happen, the disposal of the dead system that the Zoroastrians use, Lokman Ashini, or the sky burial as it's called, would have been overwhelmed by the sheer number of corpses. And in exceptional cases, burials are done by the Parsis. So we hypothesize that this is possibly a Zoroastrian cemetery talking about the terminal event at Sanjan. Possibly. It might be a non-Zoroastrian cemetery also. There are men and women, and the entire event seems to be more or less, well, taking place at one time as such. All the bodies are almost at the same level. All the graves are shallow. There are absolutely no grave goods. And interestingly, the feet, if you notice, are incredibly close together. And the hands actually are across the chest like this. Now, Zoroastrian burials are made with the toes, the big toes of the feet being tied together and the hands being wrapped around and the faces turned to the right. This fits all those criteria. But it also fits all the criteria for an Islamic burial, which is north-south with the face turned towards Mecca. So I'm not saying these are most definitely Zoroastrian burials. We think they could be. Perhaps they're not. We did speak to the local Muslim population and they were very adamant that as far as they were concerned, they had never had a burial ground over here. And these were not theirs because they were too shallow. I don't know. So this is human skeleton one from Sanjan, whom we called Adi. Just because we had to give them names, you know, it's kind of macabre. Archaeologists do these things. And this is human skeleton number two. There was probably a tree at some time growing over HS2's head, which has completely destroyed the upper portion of the body. This is HS3. Interestingly, it's a female skeleton, and she's almost 5'10". Very tall woman for that time. This is HS4, which is also a female burial, who's incredibly short and would have been barely 5 foot tall. We also did a lot of work at the creek at Sanjan. The year before, there had been a massive flood in the creek and had washed away the sides underneath the road. There's a road on top where that kid is sitting, and that's why this portion hasn't got washed away. So it had exposed a lot of foundations. We helped clear up those foundations and expose them a little more to show you the kind of activity that was taking place. We also managed, thanks to the floods and the washing away, to track down the extent of the site. We have a site that's roughly 2 kilometers by 1 kilometer. And that's huge for this time and place. If you go by what Professor Sharma and Professor Habib would like you to know, that there are supposedly no large urban settlements during this period. This is urban decay and feudalism and whatnot. Sanjan seems to disagree with this, and the more work that we've done on the coast, the western coast of India, definitely seems to disagree with both Professor Sharma and Professor Habib, and we think that perhaps their hypothesis is not applicable to the west coast of India. I don't know about the east coast. We took up excavations here purely because we found bricks jutting out at the bed of the river, essentially over here. So these bricks were jutting out in the riverbed, and it made no sense because the lowest foundations were about 5 feet above them. So we decided to put in a quick trench. We had a 4-day window between the tides, creeping up and creeping down. So we're exactly in between two events, so it's in the full moon and the new moon. And well, as you notice, this is how far the water came up the day before I took the night before I took these photographs. We backfilled the trench that day and the water was already in the trench. So this is Aravalli helping clear. What we have here is the base of a huge square well. So that's why it's so much below the rest of the foundations. It's a well cutting into the silt. And we collected an enormous amount of ceramic from this. In 4 feet, we had over 200 kilos of pottery. Some amazing ceramics came out of this, especially local ceramics. This is the Kolikhadi area. Before we excavated the skeletons, we had to also expose a little more. We had a lot of working areas, brick bat floors, beautiful sunken troughs that were sunken into the ground to hold water, which is the way they were and they are in villages even today. This is the same trough. We had a UNESCO exhibition with Parzor in 2003 in Mumbai. So this is the same trough after we put it together. That's Dr. Dandekar taking it out, numbering the pieces one by one as we put them in. And 700 rupees of super glue and skin of a lot of thumbs and fingers went into putting it back together. This is probably the prize exhibit. Have they put it up at the exhibition? I think they have. So this is a three-handled Sasanian Islamic turquoise glazed ware jar. This was found interestingly at the bottom of one of the ring wells. Plain buff ware. Interestingly, we also found some Chinese ceramics. These are the Yu, Y-E-U-H, and Qingbai, Q-I-N-B-A-I, ceramics of the 11th century AD. And definite evidence of people stopping by from the Persian Gulf and on their way back. So we have the turquoise glazeware ceramics coming out. So those are large jars which are meant for, you know, transporting goods. And these are, of course, small bowls and things like that. In the early Islamic period, the Chinese ceramics were much sought after in the Persian world until the Persians figured out how to replicate them. That's another headache that archaeologists have, and well, never mind that. This is a beautiful floral lip-shaped stoneware bowl, some painted glazed buffware, more painted glazed buffware. It's a tiny bowl for drinking. Plain buffware. This was unique. We have only one example of this from the site. This is what is called tin glazed ware. This is very interesting. This is something called graffito ware. Now, graffito ware is very interesting because it has a very, very tight window. It was made between 950 and 1050 AD. That's it. So when the glaze is wet, using a blunt pen-like instrument, you peel away the glaze by making graffiti on it. So most of it is absolutely random. Some of it is floral. Some of it sometimes, like this looks like horses running across a field if you use a little imagination. There's something that looks like a flower over here, and this maybe is a flower, and this is something floral, but more abstract than anything else. And color is splashed on them and splashed around the rims. These are some of the bases to give you the idea of the splashing and the geometric motifs that you see, which are made into the bases. There's a lot of hatching between the lines. This to me looks like peacocks, but I am told that this is also what is often called pseudo graffiti or pseudo writing, but it looks like peacocks to me. Note the inverted commas so I can get away with it. This we found in the fourth season. This is the Kashan luster glazed ware bowl. It's a very funny depiction. We have three more vessels with the same image on them. And that is definitely pseudo writing on it. Basically, what is happening is that people want bowls with writing in them. But the potters are illiterate, as are the people buying the bowls. So the potter makes it look like writing and sells it to the guy and says, see, the beautiful inscription on it. Lovely. The guy says, oh, lovely. Right? And it's a funny bird with a long beak with four legs. It's a four-legged bird with a huge beak looking back over its back. We have some other examples of it. This is the outside of the same bowl. very beautiful, typical example of Kashan luster glazed ware. We also have something which we called eggshell ware, which looks and feels like eggshells. And again, note the Chinese in inverted commas inscribed. This only this one pattern inscribed on all of the ceramics. This is the only intact local ceramic object that we have found. Otherwise, it's all tons and tons of potsherds. It's a tiny little bowl. And this is one of the most beautiful terracotta objects I've seen from this period. It's a beautiful globular pot onto which has been appliqued before firing an entire elephant wearing bracelets on its front legs. And this is some kind of a ink pot or some kind of a vessel, completely hollow. And so in the fourth season, we decided to take up excavations on another periphery of the mound at a place which was locally called a bhastu by the local Machis. Now, bhastu is another slang term which they use for the Towers of Silence of the Parsis elsewhere up and down the coast. And therefore, we decided to investigate this mound. Whilst we were doing so, we were also trying to dig up data, and we found out that it had probably been investigated earlier and that we were actually coming back to this place, and it had actually been published, but nobody had ever really noticed it. So this is after we finished. All those trees are back. So tree lovers don't have to feel bad about those khajuris missing. We trimmed them down. They were back the next year. This is the Dokhma, and this is the eastward facing entrance, which is classic of all Zoroastrian Towers of Silence. It is always slightly off center. This is some brick riveting that has survived in the center. The entire walls of the torus are made of debris from the site, which is really weird. It's a debris wall. It's not a brick wall, okay? And most of the wall has given way outwards, so, and collapsed, making the torus even larger. So we took a cross section right through it. In the center, there was a 6 foot wide circle to lay down the bodies. And further in the center was a beautiful brick-lined well in which we found the remains of a large number of Parsis. Those are some of the remains. On the top is the collapsed debris and the subsequent surface layer that has built up over time, the humus that has formed. And underneath layer four is essentially the natural soil in the area. This is giving you an internal view of the Dokhma. And you can see the brick built well, okay? And the bottommost line projects inwards of bricks and was completely coated in lime. There was a lot of lime that had been added to help the bones decompose, or at least the flesh to decompose on the bones. Dr. Veena Mushrif has done quite a bit of work on the bones from Sanjan, and she says that there were roughly the remains. Looking at the size of the Dokhma, looking at what we've got from the area, we've got that the remains of between 500 to 600 individuals inside the Dokhma at any given time, or at least when the last event occurred. This is a better view of the inside after we've removed all the bones. This was also something very interesting. We found a lot of glass bangle fragments like we find in most early historical and medieval excavations in India. Here we have a lot of intact bangles from the Dokhma, and in this case you can see the articulated bangle with the humerus and the radius and the ulna, still articulated in place. These are some of the intact glass bangles. The majority of glass bangles are black, as opposed to red, which is the color that is worn by most Parsi women today. These are black. Now, it's very interesting. Parsi women took on wearing bangles as a sign of being married only after coming to India. So there is no tradition of doing this in Persia. They also adopted a local tradition of wearing toe rings as a sign of being married. And this was discontinued about 220 or 225 years ago, when there was a firman that was sent out, saying, you can't do this. This is not our tradition. So there was actually a saying till that period amongst the Parsis. Parsi women, married women, were supposed to say that I want to go with my bangles on, which meant I want to die before my husband. I want to pre-decease my husband. So I want to be taken to the Towers of Silence with my bangles still on me. So even though the body is laid without any clothes in the Towers of Silence, women's bodies would have been placed with the bangles and their touring still on them as symbols of their being married when they died. These are the varieties of tourings that we discovered from the Dakma, apart from the one at bottom extreme right, which we excavated from the site. So that made us quite happy, because we had a link, however tenuous, between the rings from the Dokma and the tourings from the habitation mound. So this is the view of the habitation mound from across the creek. And those are two women, Machi women, catching mudfish over there. And this is our site over here, and this is our site supervisor standing there. And this is our excavation. You can see the poles around the trench over here. Again, the same brickbat jelly. But interestingly, we had a beautiful platform floor around it and an intact well. So remember, I showed you the Kashan luster glazed ware and the other ceramics. They came from this well. Every 9 or 10 rows, there's an inset, and then it goes down, and then there is another inset every 9 or 10 rows, and it goes down. Every alternate set, there is a large tree trunk like pole that goes through and through, for which you can still see only the post holes. And for a change, we actually have horizontal post holes running in instead of vertical post holes like we normally find in an excavation. On the site, we found a huge number of sculptural and structural temple members. So this is a Matrika image that we have from the site. I think this is Brahmi. I mean, it's open to interpretation. Famous lotus bud imagery from structural fragments. A huge Kubera image some distance from the site. Don't miss the coins coming out of the mongoose skin pouch. Very unadorned, as one would expect the Rashtrakuta, perhaps, style to be. Part of a Gajathara panel, being presently worshipped in a temple which we had to kind of drag the pujari away and sneak in and take some quick pictures because he was adamant at not letting us come nearby. Alongside the Gajathara panel, you notice another panel that is at a right angle to it, and this has dancing warriors running across it. So scattered all around the site are a large number of these panels, and the size of some of these panels, and I mean, I could go on and on for a couple of hours just on the sculptural stuff. The temple was very large. We have a huge kichaka, which is about this big. And it would not have belonged to a three-sided kichaka. It would not have belonged to a tiny shrine. So there was at some point a large temple over here. The coins of Amogha Varsha are probably a hint to the temple, because we know that during Amogha Varsha's time, there was an enormous drought in the Konkan. And Amogha Varsha traveled north to the temple of Mahalakshmi. And then on the Balipitha of the temple of Mahalakshmi, Amogha Varsha sliced off his own finger to the goddess. And they say when he did this, it poured and poured and poured, and the rains came. So we have always wondered whether the Mahalakshmi temple about 40 kilometers south, 30 to 40 kilometers south today, is a very modern temple at Charoti. Would it possibly have been originally at Sanjan? Because Sanjan is the only large urban settlement that we have found to date in this region. And that perhaps these are the remnants of that Rashtrakuta Shilahara style temple from this region. This is a beautiful image of Parvati. You can see the Ganesha in the left hand, upper hand, left, lower hand. You can see the Kamandalu. I mean, if the right was there, logically there would have been a Shiva, Shivalinga in right upper, and right lower would have had Akshamala. And quite a beautiful but late-looking sculpture. Interesting Bhairava image with the loose jatas. Now, before we went to Sanjan and excavated there, all we had was Banbhor in Sindh and Mantai in Sri Lanka. The entire stretch of coast from Banbhor to Mantai in northern Sri Lanka was terra incognita for the early medieval period. Before we started working at Sanjan, the Durham University and the Archaeological Survey of India took up excavations at Chandor in Goa, the Kadamba capital, and sadly, with the death of Varaprasad Rao, the report never emerged for the site, and I don't think there's even any trace of articles on that site. So while doing our work, we found out that there was some work being done at Chandor and there were similar ceramics being recovered there. We published a lot of preliminary reports in rapid succession in Puratattva and in the Journal of Indian Ocean Studies. Volumes 1 and 2 of Indian Ocean Studies, and I think either 32 or 33 of Puratattva, which was our first report. So we didn't know whether we'd actually get around to publishing a final report because we didn't have the space, we didn't have the funds and things like that. And one of the things I wanted to do was make sure we had a large, concise preliminary report out every year. So at least we managed to get that done. Thanks to the materials that we identified at Sanjan, we know for a matter of fact that there are coeval sites at Kamraj, Hathab, Tsaul, Chinchani, Kelshi and Pattanam. Subsequently, A.S. Gore of the National Institute of Oceanography has a shipwreck of this period in the Gulf of Khambat, which at very low tides is accessible by foot. We have also found subsequently similar ceramics at Sanjan, at Chandor, where I am excavating just now, at Masla, at Divyagar, at Borli. We have about 24 coeval sites in the Chandor region where I am excavating and exploring now that I know what to look for. The ceramics have been very helpful, but more than the ceramics, the numismatic evidence has been very helpful in helping us date a lot of these sites. We are changing the way we are looking at the Indian Ocean littoral, especially during the early medieval period. I mean, I don't speak for the early historic period, that is not my area of expertise. But in the early medieval period, we have realized that definitely there are certain important factors that need to be taken into consideration. The first is that almost all the trade that we are seeing is after the consolidation of empire by the Arabs in Persia. There is a sort of Pax Islamica, which is resulting in an enormous amount of trade coming out of the Persian Gulf and the Red Sea, extending throughout the Indian Ocean littoral. We think that at Sanjan, we also have a few ceramics maybe from Africa, but because there isn't enough work being done there, we have always left that as a could be, looks like, possibly. And we have, as I said, plugged in a lot of holes that we had before this. So this is my map after Sanjan. Okay, so there's Banbhor on the top, there's Mantai on the bottom, there's Sanjan in pink, and they're the other coeval sites that we managed to knock down. South of Kelshi, there are no more sites, not because there aren't sites. It's because nobody has worked yet south of Kelshi on the coast. But we now have another probable site about 30 kilometers north of the Goa border, which we are working on at a place called Pendur. Definitely coeval structural and sculptural remains, amazing set of Jaina temples belonging to the 11th, 12th centuries AD. And entire routes that we're being able to map through inland ports and things like that in the Pendur region. And we have, of course, the site of Chandor. We hope that the ASI's report comes out on that site. And there's Pattanam in Kerala. And we're hoping and praying that the Pattanam team starts working up and down the coast now and nailing a lot of other sites with single trench excavations so that we know about other coeval locations there. I am told that there is work being done in Tamil Nadu also. Sadly, I do not know anybody working on the coast of Karnataka, and I don't understand why. But if there is somebody, I'd be very happy to work with them or help them or even talk to them. But does anybody know anybody working in Karnataka on the coast? Nobody. There's nobody working in Karnataka. I don't know why. So, in any case, we now have more than 15 sites on the coast. And these are the two people who actually drove the excavation. Sadly, they're no longer with us. That's Dr. Mani Kamerkar on the right and Dr. S.P. Gupta on one of their rare visits to the site to see what we were doing and to keep an eye on us. This is my team. Believe me, they never looked this clean when they were working for me and refused to let me take a group picture till they all got dolled up on the last payday. So this was my labor gang over there. And almost impossible to get men to work for you amongst the Machis. Machi men are the laziest buggers in the world. So that's Ishwar Bawa on the right, who was my foreman, and everybody else is related to him in some way or the other. These were our my bap at the site. Locals at Sanjan, the Davirwala family, Mr. and Mrs. Davirwala, Mr. Davirwala sadly passed away. That's me in the hat behind his shoulder and Dr. Dhala of the WZCF. And these people made our lives worth living over there, regularly fed us and took care of our non-spiritual needs. This is part of the team that was there one of the seasons after playing Holi. So that's Dr. Kajle, who's done some interesting flotation work over there. Dr. Abhijit Dandekar, Rahul Oak, Rukshana Nanji, Pranab Sharma, Shivendra Kadgaonkar, and Suresh Bomble. And this is where we used to have lunch every day, next to the famous Moon Moon Talkies. And Moon Moon Talkies would only have a show if enough people gathered outside it. So at showtime, you had to, if there were 15 people, there'd be a show. If there were less than 15 people, sorry. I even offered to buy 15 tickets once. 15 people have to go in for there to be a show. So thank you very much for being a very patient audience. If anybody has any questions, I'd be happy to take them.
Why do you call it Sasanian Islamic architects?
No. Just this one ceramic is called Sasanian Islamic turquoise glazed ware. The reason it is called this is a terminal Sasanian ceramic. Right at the end of the Sasanian period in the 7th century AD, this ceramic appears for the first time. It continues to be used throughout the early Islamic period all the way to the 11th century AD.
That means so originally it is Sasanian.
The original ceramic was Sasanian. It's now euphemistically called Hib ware. Don't ask me why Hib. I haven't quite figured that out. But turquoise glazed ware is what we normally use in archaeological circles. Anybody else?
Any questions?
Please.
As a layman, I would like to know that the what is the area of total occupation at Sanjan?
Sir?
1 minute. What is the total, the stratigraphical deposit at the site? What is the nature of the town planning? Because at least while we are excavating, 2-3 major issues which are to be taken into consideration. First, the area of occupation, the number of the areas which were remain under occupation, total stratigraphy of the sites, and the settlement pattern. So that is my general question.
So I'll tell you what how it worked out for us. So as I said, sadly, we had very few funds to mount an excavation of large scale. So as to the town planning as such, it was very difficult to say. But from the long sections that we got along the river, which we were able to trim and brush, houses seem to have been laid at clear intervals of about 2 meters between them. In fact, we had a continuous stretch of houses without any gap for a span of almost 200 meters, which we could expose over there. The total mound size or the extent of the remains was about 2 kilometers by 1 kilometer. Sadly, the center of the mound, that is, okay, so this is where my trenches are, concentrated in the first and second season over here and here. Okay, this is my fourth season Lokma mound over here. This is the peripheral cemetery area at Kolikhadi. Okay, Now, this area in between, which is untouched over here, has been completely dug out by bulldozers all the way to virgin soil and taken away to build bricks. Now, this is supposed to be a tribal property and therefore nobody can own it. It is an unprotected site. Officially, nobody can buy land over there to settle there. It is the Machiwad. But what has been happening is the Machis over years incur debt with the local Muslim community. And then at some point, write off their debt by giving a piece of land away to a local person. Now, the original Muslim town of Sanjan Bandar, which is essentially over here in this area, is incredibly compact.
Muslim or Parsi town?
Muslim town. The Parsis left a long time ago, sir. There are few Parsis that are there are here at the railway station. And have come back only after the new Sanjan was created. I don't know, sir. I don't know, sir. These are Konkani Muslims and have nothing to do with any invasions whatsoever. In fact, there was a Muslim governor of Sanjan during the Rashtrakuta period. We have the copper plates of the Rashtrakuta emperors who very characteristically and categorically tell us that there was a local governor of the Vetakula of Sanjan who was a Muslim. So Muslims have been living on this coast way before any invasions took place. There were Christian communities and Parsi communities on the coast, and there was an enormous amount of trade with the Islamic West way before the invasions. The invasions all took place at the end of the 13th century. In 1297 AD, my good friend Sultan Mahmud, or Muhammad Alauddin Khilji, made the first incursions down the coast. He took the coastal route and came upon Deogiri quite by surprise. We have from the surface at the Kolikhadi Mound, embedded in the surface, as in it came out in the first dig, a beautiful copper coin of Alauddin Khilji. It's very tempting to make that conclusion that it was him who was responsible for the destruction of Sanjan. It seems to fit the rest of the data, especially because he was Sultan, you know, a Sultan al-Dunya, Sultan Muhammad on his coins, and he also was the first person recorded to have a general called Alf Khan. He was also the first Sultan Muhammad to invade down this area. So it's very tempting to put two and two together and make 10. But you really can't definitively say that. Yes, he's a very strong contender, but so is Muhammad Begra. And there are 250 years between them. Okay? But there is nothing else that I have from the 13th century AD at Sanjan. The next occupational phase is actually Christian. When the fort of Sanjan is built by the Portuguese, and a large number of, that's a lecture for some other day, there is an enormous Portuguese occupation in that area. And then, subsequent to the removal of the Portuguese in 1730s by the Marathas, we have the Sanjan village or the Sanjan Bandar town of the Muslims who were trading out of here. These are Konkani Muslim traders, and they were trading with the Persian Gulf, and they were part of the wood trade till about 40 years ago. So whether they chased them away and settled here or not is a different thing altogether. It's a very good location, so you know, and it's next to Basra. Why would people not settle there? Yes, sir.
These ring wells, I'm interested in those. What do you think was the purpose of these ring wells, and whether these formed part of any structure?
So they were attached to a structure, sir.
Okay.
And in both phases, they were attached to a structure, and were very, very clearly used for sewage. Of the structure itself. There is absolutely no two ways about it. In fact, very interestingly, the upper pair of ring wells at their base had a beautiful pile of charcoal put down before the well was used. And we retrieved a large amount of, you know, there's a solid bulk of charcoal over there. In fact, if you look, Ringwell, the lower period Ringwell, of course, was on bedrock. This is bedrock here. You can't get lower than this. So this entire pit over here was full of charcoal. Now, the purpose of putting the charcoal is very interesting. If you have an open sewage pit, which is a soakage pit, you put charcoal at the bottom because this prevents hydrogen sulfide gas from being created. So it doesn't stink. So you do not put this unless you have a sewage pit per se. You understand? So The fact that they were being used as sewage pits is very obvious. And when the next successive occupation took place, the same strategy was used. Now, the difference, sir, here is that the lower ring well is very finely made, very well fired, almost vertical sides on the rings. The upper ring well has sloping sides and is not very well fired at all. These ring wells almost got me killed. Till we exposed the ring wells, nobody came to even look at the site. The moment the ring wells were exposed, I had people coming in buses from neighboring villages, and they were sure that there was gold inside them. So I had to mount four people as guards in the night so that somebody wouldn't plow through my ring wells till I'd taken photographs of them in section at least, if nothing else. So, yeah, these ring wells are not a very nice thing to have. I've had the same problem in Rajasthan at Balathal when they were sure it was a koti full of gold. So the total depth of is seen over here is about 5 meters, okay? Little less than 5 meters. But please note, this is a mistake over here. That's why we haven't been using this frame really. This shouldn't have been here. This is where the occupation actually starts from. This is period one. This. This is period two. And this is the terminal occupation of the site. Now, there is an enormous amount of bioturbation on the top of the mound. Enormous. Massive amounts of termites, huge rainfalls. The entire upper horizon is brickbat jelly. So we had a long time trying to figure out what the problem was here. We finally had Dr. Rajguru come down, and he was very clear that this was essentially due to the nature of the climate in this region, subsequent to the desertion of the site, that led to the creation of this brickbat jelly on top. And I kind of can't disagree with him on that. So there were three occupational phases. Now, to make matters more difficult, at the bottom of the excavation, we found three sherds of, I shouldn't even say this actually, but we found three sherds specifically. Please note, especially the archaeologists in the crowd, of RPW. Three sherds of RPW. Red polished ware. Now this is what gets even worse here. One sprinkler, one spout, and one body sherd. So two diagnostic sherds out of three. I mean, I just can't put my head around. We never found a single sherd anywhere else on the site. Right at the bottom over here, roughly in this area over here, we found these three sherds. Nowhere else where we excavated, we spent 3 seasons, 3 months each year scouring the site for material from the surface. We didn't find a single sherd of RPW.
Does this hint of an early historic
occupation? I don't know. I've wondered whether somebody picked up these diagnostics because they looked interesting and brought them along with him, her, it. Because it doesn't make sense. If there was an occupation, then somewhere there should be something else on the site that says RPW, right? And the RPW dates itself, I mean, I don't even want to get into that early historic conundrum. Those dates are another problem altogether.
But that also depends how much
area you have excavated. So I'm not saying that the excavated, I'm saying the explored region. In the explored area also, we did not find a single other sherd. At least one we should have found. And it's a huge area with lots of gullies, lots of ruined areas, lots of dugout areas, not one sherd ever. Not one coin of an earlier period. Not any other ceramics of an earlier period. Just these damn three sherds together at one spot. Yes, there could have been an earlier occupation. I don't know. But on three sherds, I will not say that there was an early historic occupation. So along with this, we have a lot of local ceramics of the medieval period. Dr. Dandekar now has an entire profile that is created for local ceramics. We are seeing the same at other sites now. At Saul, at Chinchani, at Sandor, we are seeing the same kind of material coming up. We also had the usual iron implements, you know, nails and fragments and things like that, sir, which are completely inconsequential. We had a beautiful Ganesha figurine in terracotta about this big, in tiny pieces because it got hit by the tikau. And it has to be stuck together one of these days. Sadly, there was a major disagreement on the publication of the data, and well, we are at a bit of an impasse on that. So, as completely out of my, please ask Dr. Dimri, he will be able to tell you. Or Dr. Pandey, RPW supposedly is demonstrative of the Indo-Roman period, but there are sites where it seems to occur before, there are many sites that occurs after, and I am for a much later date than the...
Can I just ask from a layman's point of view?
Please, ma'am.
You've done all of these subsequent digs as well, up and down that part of the coast. Do you see the same pattern of mobility and settlement in all these
areas? I'll tell you something very interesting, ma'am. I mean, it's not really part of today's talk. But where we're excavating just now, we are able to show you 800 years of continuity of occupation at the same location. From the 11th, 12th century AD in the Shilahara period to date, I can not just show you occupation on the site, I can even show you how over 800 years, the components of the site, the subcomponents, have remained in the same general position. There is a little lateral shifting. But every site in Maharashtra, every village has what are called wadis. You know, the word wado is used south and pada is used in the north, that kind of thing. So there are subunits of a village. So there are 7 subunits to the village of Sanjan today, to the village of Chandor today. And I have evidence from the Shilahara period for 7 units. More or less stable, give or take.
Littoral and the coastal areas had a very dynamic population that sort of moved. We're not actually, I mean,
that's an assumption, ma'am.
Yeah, exactly. That's sort of
my data on the ground tells you that there are some very interesting things happening before the early medieval period, which I don't know. But from the early medieval period to date, the occupations have been more or less continuous, more or less. There have been periods when populations have shrunk. There have been periods where they have had to be revitalized. Now, I'm going to say something that I hope this is not being recorded because otherwise I'm going to be nailed to the cross for this. But Maharashtra's coast is a very, very poor land. It only flourishes when there is overseas trade. It does amazingly, spectacularly well when there is overseas trade. When trade dies, the urbanization of these areas disappears. When they are no longer part of the trade network, these regions fall back into a kind of rural dormancy. And this is something we are seeing on the ground today. When we are excavating, when we are looking at the sites, we're looking at the spread of things, we are looking at an enormous amount of different kind of marker that has never been quantified before. We are using memorial stones, we are using Asker stones, we are using Gaivasru pillars, and the kind of demographics that are coming in, the kind of understanding that is coming in of this period is very different from that which has been assumed before. And we are also assuming, we are also presuming. So there are, it is, we have to nail things down more and more tightly. It's taken me 4 years of excavating. In little, my at Chandor, my entire deposit is 30 centimeters. In 30 centimeters, I can show you 600 years of continuous occupation. Because the site formation processes in that region are very, very different. There are incredibly dynamic site formation processes. Sometimes my entire layer is just pottery. There is nothing else in it virtually. So you have to take in enormous amounts of data in very, very different forms from those we see in excavations in the Ganga Valley or across the Ghats, where sites give you beautiful stratigraphies of, you know, 7 meters and 12 meters. I mean, I worked at Balathal for my PhD. 7.25 meters of occupation. Okay? Beautiful. But not here. On the coast, see, on the coast, we have very few sites. And it's always been one of the bugbears. Why are there no sites on the coast? It's not that there are no sites. What we are saying at Chandor is you just didn't know how to look for them. Come and we'll show you how to look for them. We now have 24 locations in and around Chandor, where we had Chandor when we went in the first year. So we are saying there are sites. It's just that the traditional ways in which archaeologists label something a site and the expectations that they have are assumed. You cannot go into a site with preconceived notions like this. You have to go into the site blind, deaf and dumb and feel your way around till you find what you have to find. And it is incredibly dynamic, the coast. Incredibly dynamic. The kind of sites that we are finding just now are crazy. There's an enormous amount of work still to be done. For example, something like the Asker stones, the Gadegals. For a very long time, they were never studied purely because it was considered off-putting topic. See, it was visually not appealing to have a study of a stone on which a woman was being sodomized by a donkey. But it was the content above that was important. And it was the context of the stones that was important and which was being completely lost. So we've just done a project. When we started working on the project, we had 30 known examples from Maharashtra. We expected to find maybe 60. When we stopped documenting them after 6 months, we had 125 Gadegals that we have recorded in Maharashtra. And these are without a village-to-village survey. These are just going on leads. So what we're looking at are phenomenons that have been swept under the table, under the carpet for various different reasons. You know, the British Museum has an entire cupboard, okay, which is accessible to anybody who asks to see it, but is not accessible to the general public because they just don't know it's there. Because everything that's in it is considered very vulgar. 4,000 Moche ceramics were destroyed by the excavator of one of the largest Moche sites because he found that they were too difficult to look at. You know, there's stuff like this that happens. So we have a lot of Victorian hangovers in India, enormous Victorian hangovers in India. So when my student, Ms. Harshada Virkut was studying the Gadegals, regularly she would be asked questions like, why are you, a girl like you, doing something like this? And how can you do something like this being a woman? And she was like, even more reason to do this, right? But so this kind of thing. And there are some very interesting phenomena that are taking place in the 10th, 11th century AD on a societal level, which also have to be looked into, especially in Western India. We are seeing the ramifications across India. The impact of the Gadegals in Western India, which we thought was a Western Indian phenomena, today we are seeing in Bengal and in Bihar, and perhaps even in Orissa. So there is a lot of dynamic in India that needs to be re-looked at, a lot of data needs to be re-looked at. I keep feeling that there's just too few of us, and there's always the permanent complaint that there's not enough money. In my case, I don't have a problem with the money so much because there's a lot of stuff that can be done with very little money. But I want more warm bodies. I want more people to do these things. So the young people sitting here are welcome to come down. I will promise you blood, sweat, and tears. And amazing joy of discovery. And no money. And don't even dream of a job. I got my first job in archaeology when I was 42. And my position at the University of Mumbai, as it appears on my payslips as and when they turn up, is assistant professor, ad hoc, purely temporary. Note, purely temporary. I mean, it galls. It's not even temporary, it's purely temporary. And my tenure gets re-signed by the VC if he's in a good mood every 6 months. So, yeah. So don't look for jobs. Look for the joy, the satisfaction. I tell you, there's nothing like finding something that hasn't been seen by human eyes for 500 or 800 or 1,000 years. It's a different kind of joy. That little elephant vessel, we found it bum first in the mud. I still remember when we brushed it clean. Okay, so there are moments of great euphoria. 98% of archaeology is incredible boredom. Okay, 2% is mind-blowing manic elation. So, well, if you want to do something like that, I am the young people over here.
I'd like to thank Dr. Dalal for the lovely paper that's presented. It's an eye-opener. It has answered a lot of questions, but has also opened a lot of avenues and research for scope for research, and also for people to see the early medieval period with a new perspective and ask better and new questions. Thank you.
Thank you very much for having me here. Debris, sir? Pleasure, sir.